Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 81 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back. Welcome aboard. I like to think that this show focuses on people and their personalities first, and then the activities second. And today's episode is definitely one of those episodes. This is one that very much focuses on person and personality. I'm very interested to see how people respond to this episode because this is an atypical, but I think very entertaining episode of this podcast. We are speaking to Daniel Elson. He is an animator and canyoneer here in Los Angeles, known for a rather ridiculous mustache. And on this episode, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about all sorts of things not related to the outdoors. His history in animation, what it's like working in that industry, why I do this show. We're going to throw sarcastic barbs back and forth at each other. We're going to talk about that ridiculous hipster mustache. We're going to talk about California zebras and BB guns. And eventually, this show does start talking about the outdoors and canyoneering. Also, at the end, he is going to voice some very unpopular opinions. We talk all the time about all of the great benefits of being part of the outdoor community, and Daniel is going to talk about some of those toxic elements and some of the things he really doesn't like about the community. And he's going to make a lot of half-serious generalizations about it, but if you listen through that and really listen, you're going to hear him make some very valid points about elitism and egotism. And by the end, we'll be talking kumbaya style about how to nurture new people into the outdoors and not make all of these activities elitist activities. You're in for a ride today. I want to mention right now, we are having an uncharacteristically rainy Los Angeles winter. Typically, we record these episodes outside, and because of the rain, this is one of two episodes this season that got recorded in the makeup room at Butcher Bird Studios, so it's a little more echoey than typical episodes, and you won't get to hear pretty birds and things in the background, but it's totally listenable. I just figured I'd give you that heads up. That's enough fluff. Let's go talk to Daniel Elson and his Stalin-esque mustache.
My name is Daniel Elson. I don't really want anybody to know anything about me. Everything on the internet is fake. It's all untrue. I go outside. That's why you asked me to be here.
That's all you got to say about yourself?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Are you sincerely trying to hide your past from everyone?
Well, I mean, if you admit to that, you're not doing a good job of it. That's a trick question. What do you want to know about my past? What is it that's fascinating about it?
I don't know if there's anything fascinating.
There's not. That's why I'm not sure why you invited me to be on this. Well, I could interview you. We could flip this around.
And what would you interview me about?
Why you do this show.
Well, I mean, you're definitely welcome to ask that question, even though it's been answered on this show like 10 times before.
Yeah, but nobody listens to your show, and like 10,000 people are going to listen to this episode because I'm on it, and they know nothing about your show.
All right, so are we sincerely starting over? Do you want to...
No.
Are you happy with what you got?
Are you happy? This is your big day, Jason.
I don't know. You seem very concerned about how you're going to be represented on this. So make sure you're happy with this.
I could give you a wonderful interview, and then you could chop up every word until it's like, I'm a big dumbass. Like, you could just take that sound bit right there, and you could just, hi, I'm Daniel Elson. I'm a big dumbass. Cut it together. There's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, you pretty much just gave me the entire episode.
There it is.
Yeah, 45 minutes of Daniel Elson saying he's a big dumbass.
Hi, I'm Daniel Elson. I'm a big dumbass. Big dumbass. Daniel Elson, dumbass. Hi, I'm Daniel Elson. I'm a big dumbass. Big. Hi, I'm Daniels. I'm a big dumbass. Dumbass. Yeah, no, I've had bad experiences with the entertainment industry, so this is not something I would normally be okay with.
But because you have such great trust in me.
No. This is obviously still something I'm not okay with. I'm doing this because I like you. So why do you do this show?
Do you really want me to say why I do the show?
Yeah, I'd like to know why you do the show.
I'll make it quick because this is not a show about me.
That's fine.
So I grew up in Louisiana.
All right.
Right? I grew up in Baton Rouge where people hunt and fish. That's pretty much the gamut of outdoor activities. So, or at least when I was growing up, there were a little concept of other things. Surrounded by woods, you can spend a lot of time in the woods, but there's no like hiking really or climbing or anything of that nature in that area. I moved to Los Angeles when I was 25, so 16 years ago. During the time that I was here, I'd moved here with a girlfriend. We broke up after 8 years, which was about 4 years later than we should have, which I think is a pretty typical story. Reflected on my life, looked at how my life had turned into something that didn't look anything like what I wanted my life to be, and then decided to change my life into something that I wanted it to be, which ended up being a variety of things. One of those things was I joined an outdoor club because I was always interested in those kinds of activities and just kind of ran with that. Found that the life I had was much more rewarding than it had been for a few years before that. It was changing in a way that was closer to what I wanted my life to be. As much as doing a lot of this shit is just fun, I also think the things you learn about yourself, the ways you learn to deal with other people, communicate with people, face challenges, help you improve just in general throughout your life. This show is sort of a way for people to discuss those topics and not to form a community, but just so people can get to know other people in the community, whether it's community they're directly related to or just community they're related to because they have similar interests. And so it's a show for people who are interested in the outdoors or already get outdoors to hear other people like them instead of always looking at athletes that they can't identify with, telling them about lifestyles that they can't identify with. They can actually hear from other people maybe they can identify with and then maybe take steps to improve their life or change their life or do the things in their life that they're interested in doing. So that answer your question?
Yeah. You've ruined the episode by talking, but no. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, my story is not terribly different from that. I moved out here a little over 8 years ago.
Yeah, where are you from? I don't even have any idea where you grew up or anything.
I'm from the Midwest. I was born in Illinois and then family bounced around for just a little bit. And then we landed in Ohio. And then I lived in various places in Ohio till about 30. And then my bathtub was leaking into the apartment below me. My landlord was like, you've got to move. You can move to another unit. And I have a very large collection of books, maybe like 3 pallets worth of books. I did not want to just move them downstairs, like take them off the shelves, put them in boxes, move them downstairs or down the street. So I just moved as far away from that place as possible.
So is he saying you needed to move because they needed to repair?
Yeah, they just needed to fix the bathtub. And they're like, we've got to come in here and fix shit. And I was like,
I wasn't sure if maybe they're like, your bathtub's leaking. This is somehow your fault. Yeah. You're evicted from this apartment.
When I moved into that apartment complex, it was kind of nice, and then it was taken over by somebody who turned it into like Section 8 housing. So I went from having like normal neighbors to there like being a prostitution bust in the front building, and someone set the neighbor below me, they set her car on fire and exploded in the parking lot and set a couple more cars on fire.
Wait, how long did you live in this place?
Like 10 years.
Okay, so it
like
was
10 years, yeah.
It was a change over time. It wasn't like you moved in and then 6 months later, it was a slum.
No, it was so slow I didn't notice it, but I lived on a third floor, like in an upper corner, and I never really saw anybody or interacted with any of the neighbors, so I just didn't notice it happening.
And you said this was in Ohio?
Yeah, this was in Columbus, Ohio.
So what were you doing in Columbus? Why were you there at that time?
Well, I went to art school there. Then I graduated from art school. I actually moved to LA and tried to get a job in animation, and that was 2002, so right after all of the major studios shut down their traditional animation departments. Toy Story was doing real well, and Finding Nemo.
So wait, you moved out here in 2002?
I moved out here, and I just started cold calling animation studios.
If you moved out here in 2002, because that's also when I moved out here, did you then leave and come back at
some
point?
Yeah, I stayed for like 3 months, and then I was like, fuck this.
It's funny, because despite, like, I didn't live in Ohio, I didn't live surrounded by a prostitution rink and exploding vehicles, But I also kind of came out here for the same reason at the same time, except that I didn't have proper training and the kind of animation I was most interested in and had any chance in was also being eradicated.
Yeah, it was a horrible time to relocate here. You're doing well. You're doing very well. And it took you about the same amount of time as it took me to do very well.
I would say how well I'm doing is maybe misleading. But
you've mastered the art of Hollywood where you put on a good front. It takes a long time to establish yourself in entertainment industry. At least if you're untalented like me, you have to trick a lot of people. So I went back to Ohio, got fired from a lot of jobs.
Yeah, let's hear a few stories about those firings.
Oh, shit.
Just go through a list, fired for this reason, fired for this reason. And then feel free to share as much about those reasons as you want.
Oh, my God. I blocked a lot of that out.
Consider this like a therapy session. We're just going to delve deep into your past and bring up things that seem painful, but then they're going to help you get through and push through the other side and level up.
The repression's a powerful, it's a powerful device in human nature. I'm trying to think how early I should go. I've been fired from almost every job I've had before I started working in entertainment. Now I feel like I fit in to a certain degree with all of the dorks. That or they're just like afraid I'm going to chop them up in their sleep so they don't fire me. I got fired from the photo lab in college for just sleeping on the job. I remember the dean just coming into the photo lab and being like, "Do you not want to be here?" And I just looked at him. I was like, "No, it's a job. I'm here for the money." I got fired from a coffee shop for taking a lady's order on a stapler, pretending it was a cell phone because she was on her cell phone. So I just, answered the stapler and didn't make eye contact with her. And then turned out she knew the general manager of the coffee chain. I got fired from the largest producer of Halloween props and animatronics. I was a designer and sculptor there. I got fired from that job for calling our entire company alcoholics on Fox News. That was a good interview. A lot of them I just never asked back. I was a lifeguard. I really didn't care about saving anybody's lives. They just didn't ask me back for the next summer.
The 12th drowning, they figured maybe it was time to hire somebody else.
I'd watch them drown for a little bit and give them the chance to save themselves before I jumped in. I don't think they really liked that.
Yeah, you want to empower them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of wanted them to drown. But ultimately, I ended up making fine art, like painting, and doing gallery shows to pay my rent. And then that kind of led me back into animation, where I had always wanted to work. All of that's done in other countries now. So then I started painting, and I ended up just falling back into that when I moved to LA.
Yeah, explain to people listening specifically what you do in animation, because you're a background painter, largely, right?
Yeah.
And for those that aren't, well-informed about how animation works, they might not understand what that is. So you want to give a quick explanation of what that is?
Whatever doesn't move on screen. Do you guys understand what I'm saying? It's the background. there's a little mouse in yellow pants and he comes out on screen and he walks around on a floor. I paint the floor.
You paint the environment
and
the elements of the environment that they're less likely to be interacting with.
Yeah, sometimes if it's a door or a dresser drawer, I'll have to paint that so it matches the rest of the environment. Everything's done in Photoshop now for most productions, so you save it on another layer and then you let the overseas studio make it move. This is not interesting to anybody.
You're in a section of animation that I would think the average person doesn't even recognize exists, right? Most people assume people that work in animation are character animators, if they have any sense of what that would be otherwise. And it sounds like maybe you were interested in character animation at some point. So how did you end up in the background department?
Well, character animation doesn't really exist in the United States. If you're a person, a child listening right now, and you want to grow up and be a Disney animator and draw, that position doesn't exist.
You can move to Korea, maybe.
Korea is where a lot of the animation is done, a lot of it. And now it's moved to India and Canada. Canada's got so many tax breaks that studios here are opening satellite studios up in Canada, and then they'll manage another workhorse studio in a third world country. They just make everybody draw like slaves.
So did you initially try to get in for character animation, realize quickly that that wasn't really an option, and then end up in the background department?
The first time I was able to apply for a character animation position was Disney's Frog Princess, which wasn't until 2007 or something. that was the first traditionally animated movie that had gotten made after I graduated from college. And I sent in a portfolio for that, and I even got like a letter back saying, we've received your portfolio. It's in a pile with a bunch of other ones that don't suck. You'll hear back from us shortly. I never heard back from them, which is normal, but I think I kept that letter.
So you said you went to school in Ohio. Yeah. Were you in a general arts program or were you in an animation program?
Oh, I went to Columbus College of Art and Design for animation. In the 90s, when Disney was sort of what we call like the new golden age, which really kind of started with The Little Mermaid in the late 80s and runs through the very early 2000s when they shut that studio down, both of their studios. They were hiring directly out of three schools. And there was CalArts here in California and Ringling in Florida and Columbus College of Art and Design for some reason. So that was the closest one to where I lived and the cheapest out of the three schools. And that's where I went.
So were you in a traditional animation program there?
Yes and no. I mean, I was a traditional animation major, but that school at the time, their curriculum was so 1950s that they had put animation in with the film program. And then they had put the film program with the photography program, and they just called it media studies. So for my requisite classes, I had to take film and photography, and then I would take all my electives in like zoological and botanical illustration or rapid sketch or things that pertain to a Disney animation portfolio.
So what did you think when you got out of school? Did you think you were going to become a character animator? Like, oh, I went through this program. They taught me everything I need to know.
Yeah,
and then you found out it was bullshit.
No, I actually, my portfolio was perfect for Disney. It looked great. I had really good drawing chops at that time. And I would have probably gotten a great job had there been a studio that existed. At one point in time in like the 1800s, there was somebody who had spent their entire life learning how to wood engrave. They were making all these wood engravings that they were printing in books and newspapers and stuff. And then overnight, here comes the photograph. And an entire industry just vanished overnight. I think about all those wood engravers with this beautiful age-long craft. It's just gone.
So this is an analogy for your career decisions, is what you're saying.
Well, that's what happened to traditional animation. It just vanished overnight.
So then you moved to Los Angeles to try to get into a field that was disappearing. Realized you weren't going to get into that field, went back to Ohio, became a gallery painter.
Well, I had to get fired a bunch of times first.
Right, get fired a bunch of times, and then get some paintings into galleries and somehow make a living there. What made you decide to come back out to Los Angeles?
I always wanted to live out here. I just sort of felt the calling to move west, the manifest destiny. Is that what it's called?
I don't know if that's the right term.
Am I using it?
Manifest destiny is the concept of basically like the conquistadors. It's we head out, we find new lands, we conquer and take them by manifest destiny.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Okay, so that's what you meant.
Yeah, California is mine. This is my town. It just worked out. It's just dumb luck.
Yeah, so what was different the second time?
Me? It was almost 10 years later and I was more grown up. I don't know how many other fields this pertains to, but when you first graduate as an artist from college and people ask you what you do for a living and you're like, I'm an artist, nobody takes you seriously. They're like, uh-huh. And maybe this is true for all arts and entertainment degrees. And then when you're 25, people ask you what you do for a living, you're like, I'm an artist. And they're like, uh-huh. And when you're 30, people's reaction is a little different. And they're like, oh, you're still saying that. Maybe you're serious. Now at my age, if I tell people I'm an artist, you can look them in the eye. There's zero question or doubt about whether you're fooling yourself or not. Especially in this town, a lot of people need their dreams crushed. They want to be famous or they want to be an actor and they just do not have the skill to get them there. I like to inform them that it's never going to happen. So anybody that shows me their portfolio, I'm like, uh-huh, kid, you suck. Good luck.
So you're just there to help build the dreams of the younger generation, is what you're saying?
Dream crusher.
Okay, so you come back out.
Yep.
This time you're older, moderately more mature. People take you seriously. You get into background painting.
I was just at somebody's birthday party at the Cha-Cha Lounge. I had only been here a month and they were asking me like, oh, what are you doing? How's California working out? I don't really know this person. And I was like, oh, I'm not doing anything. I need a job. And they're like, oh, you want to work in animation? And I was like, boy, do I. And gave me a test and hired me. Within weeks after that, I was working in Cartoon Network and living my dream.
I know you still work in this industry, so.
Until this comes out.
Right, right. So
for another few hours.
So how sincere you want to be about things, it's up to you. But so, based on your young Daniel concept of your future in the animation industry versus the reality of what it is now, how do you feel those two things coincide?
You mean like what I thought the industry would be like when I was a child?
Well, you said you're living your dream, and
yeah, well,
how sarcastic versus sincere is that now?
I was when you're going from being poor and destitute, painting for your rent money in Ohio, going into a big studio and having your artwork on television is a dream come true for a few weeks. And then you're like, oh man, I'm working for the man. Fuck this. But it pays so well. It pays ridiculously good. At times, it's just a job. And at other times, there's projects I'm really passionate about or really excited to be involved with. And since I'm doing backgrounds and every day is like a new painting, some days I'm painting something that looks really cool and I like doing that. And then the other days, I'm just painting some real mundane objects and stuff. So it can vary.
Yeah. What are some of the projects you've worked on that really stand out
that
you're proud of?
Do you want to name any of those companies want me talking? I'd probably violate some contract I signed. I'll talk about like specific studios and the culture at them. And it's an exciting time and a terrifying time to be involved in that industry right now because of what we call new media taking place with Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, everything streaming and all television channels. Ultimately, they're going to die. They just won't exist. Some of them are really forward thinking. You can tell that they've got executives that get it, that understand how the internet works. And then there's some of the larger studios. Their executives have been there very long. They don't know how to use an iPhone and they're going to lose a lot of money. They'll have to figure it out. They'll either partner up or buy one of these streaming companies. It's very interesting to watch it happen and be involved as it's going on because it will probably go down in history books of how we consume entertainment is going to change forever.
It's funny because in a sense, you're experiencing a different version of the same thing you experienced when you first tried to get into that industry.
Oh, yeah.
2D was being replaced almost entirely by 3D, and now you have to worry about the platforms drastically changing and how that affects your job.
But at least this time I'm on the good side of the fence.
Right.
And I'm smart enough to be able to predict certain changes and not go after specific jobs where I know it's not going to have a long life. This is not going to be interesting to anybody, but it's conversations we have at union meetings and stuff. I don't think too many people understand what is going to happen. Oh, that's uninteresting. Like, I don't want to talk about union stuff. Like,
all right, so we'll take a slight change and slight shift in gears. So we've discussed somewhat of your history, although we're leaving out a topic I think you don't want to talk about.
What?
Your reality show.
That's such a small footnote in my life. That's not... No. Hell no.
I just know that also that is apparently one of the things that's made you very distrustful of situations like this one, where people do things with your likeness.
Yeah, you have to sort of surrender control of how you're represented over to somebody else that is taking advantage of you for money or for their benefit, like you. You know, maybe you're going to make t-shirts with my face. I don't know what that contract was I signed when I came in here.
I don't think you signed anything, so I don't think I could get away with making t-shirts with your face.
Every studio I've worked at, you sign some contract when you go in, and they basically own rights to your likeness. So I've been in several episodes of different cartoons where the storyboard artist just thought it would be funny to put either like the people making the cartoons in the cartoon, or they just wanted to use me as a character at like a truck stop or something.
I think part of that is because you have an enormous mustache.
Yeah, I have a certain look that nobody forgets.
So for those listening who don't know what you look like, I would say not quite to that degree, but I could maybe describe your mustache as mildly Dali-esque.
Maybe today. Depends on how much coffee I drink.
So let's discuss the history of this mustache.
Oh, well, that's
what people really want to know about. They don't care about anything else we've talked about.
Yeah,
people want to know about the history of the Daniel Elson mustache.
That was when I was making zombies for a living. Very shortly after I got that job, the Halloween industry at that time in March, there's a massive Halloween convention where everybody in the Halloween industry goes to. And if you produce some sort of product, you have a booth at the convention. And if you have a haunted house or a Halloween shop, you go to the convention and you place your orders for the following year. And you hope you get that product before Halloween season starts. So that company I worked for, as the largest producer of Halloween props, we had this massive, massive booth in there. And we'd set up basically like a full haunted house. And people would just sort of go into our booth and we'd have all these prototypes running, pneumatic prototypes, and they placed lots of orders. We'd show up about a week before and start building this haunted house in a convention center and working like 14-hour, 18-hour days. Once the convention opened, then we just were drunk the rest of the time because there was nothing for us to do. We're not salesmen. We were all artists, so we would just drink. And for some reason, I think a bunch of people just decided they were going to grow mustaches for this convention. That's it. Like,
well, I was wondering, you're waiting for this to go. I was like, how are we getting to this? So far, this is building zombies, haunted houses, and getting drunk. I'm not sure where the mustache comes in.
The entire group of designers and artists were all a bunch of barflies. You know, we all went to the same bar and got drunk every night, and we dressed like hipsters before hipsters was a thing. It was funny at that time to just all grow mustaches. So I think society was coming off of the metrosexual fashion. Having a really nasty crustache was just kind of comical. You weren't going to make any lady friends that way. And it turned out that out of all of us that grew mustaches, mine was the only one that looked nice. And I kept it. That's it. It was like 20 years ago.
So are you saying it started as a gag and then you realized you liked it?
It started as a gag. Yeah, it was just funny. I didn't know that my mustache would look this nice.
And here it is, a defining characteristic of your personality.
This was before Urban Outfitters was selling socks with mustaches on it. It's a topic of great pain for me that a handlebar mustache did become this trendy thing for like a decade. And I don't know if it still is. I'm old now. I'm out of touch. But it was really, really annoying to me that I could go into a bar and see like five handlebar mustaches.
So your mustache is to you what the underground band that becomes super popular is to other people.
That's a really good analogy. Yeah.
So you're like, oh, look, I'm a clever, funny guy with this goofy mustache that looks amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, shit, everybody else has them now, too. They've ruined my gag. But you've decided to just hold fast, let the trend die, ride it out, and continue to this day.
If you give a fuck what other people are doing, you're not very original. Like, I don't care what they're doing. Like, my mustache looks better than their mustaches.
Have you ever been in any mustache competitions?
I've been invited so many times. In Ohio, maybe I'd see a few handlebar mustaches around, and there are always just people trying to make it look good. Just way too much wax in it. And I think that's absolutely disgusting. Like, if my mustache didn't curl on its own, I would not have this. I wouldn't put product in it. Why would anybody want a bunch of wax or goo right below their nose? And then I moved out here, and I remember going to a bar called Loaded in Hollywood, and there was five dudes with handlebar mustaches in there, and they're all dressed like migrant workers in 19th century Germany, like thin suspenders, and I was really shocked, and I was very upset, and I went home and I shaved, I believe it's called a mustache, otherwise known as like the Hitler stash. It was like the first thing I did. I was like, fuck them. I'm bringing the Charlie Chaplin back. The next day I was at the grocery store and walking through the frozen food section, and this person just sort of muttered, "How's the prison camps?" at me. And I was like, it's too soon. So I went home and shaved off that. Were we going somewhere with this story?
To let you know, I was intending to talk about your mustache originally. That was how the show was going to begin, but we talked about how you didn't want to be here instead.
Yeah, nothing's changed.
Yeah, I suspect. So a lot of people right now are like, man, we're fucking 40 minutes into this show. I thought this was an outdoor podcast.
I'm with them. I'm so with them too.
So let's shift gears now. So we've gotten as much of the history as you're willing to share at this point about your life traveling to Ohio, back and forth, getting into animation, growing a mustache, blah, blah, blah. When the hell did you start deciding to go outside and doing something other than sit at a desk and draw things and paint things all day?
I think I've always been an outdoor person. I was in the Cub Scouts growing up, so the landscape is different where I grew up. and moving to California was sort of like being in a whole new country and having all this different flora and fauna to explore. Immediately after I moved here, I was spending every weekend I could driving up Angeles Crest Highway or checking out the state parks or the city parks out towards the beach. You know, there's like 5 national parks within a few hours of living here. There's so much to do. And that's it. I moved out here and then I was like, no more cornfields and cows. There ain't all shit to look at in Ohio.
You mentioned cows and this just reminded me of something. Did you realize that there are wild zebras in California?
That's not true.
It is 100% true.
Where?
I've seen them up by Hearst Castle, south of Big Sur.
Is it sort of like the buffalo on Catalina where, you know, at one point they were there for entertainment and then they just let them go?
The moderate bit of research I did about this, because we were driving through Big Sur and I was like, are those zebras? And I looked closely and they were zebras. And I was like, there can't be zebras in California. So I looked it up, did a little bit of research. From what I gather, Hearst brought over some zebras with the intent of owning zebras for whatever reason. And zebras apparently aren't easy to domesticate, or they can't be domesticated. And so they let them loose, and now they have wild zebras running around southern Big Sur. That has nothing to do with what we were talking about, but cows made that come to mind.
Man, you all of a sudden made this show have a purpose. Like, people are getting smarter now. But there's a lot of that out here that, you know, is so crazy because of how much money there is in society out here. People do really weird shit. Like the buffalo on Catalina, or there's all these goddamn peacocks up in Sunland just walking around. Like, you know, I'd go to the zoo to see a peacock, and you could just drive through a neighborhood and the peacocks all over the fucking place.
I've got the wild parrots throughout the wild parrots. Valley too.
An entire species of parrot that nobody is sure where it came from that's been flying around Pasadena for 50 years.
And they're the loudest birds.
They were on my street last week. Yeah, just hanging out. Shot a few with a BB gun. cut that part out.
Yeah, I suspect you're full of shit, yeah. But people listening will know. And then
you'll never know.
Angry mail.
You'll never know. Did I? Didn't I?
I think the likelihood that you own a BB gun is probably not that great.
There's a BB gun in the trunk of my car right now.
Is there?
Yeah.
Does it look like a BB gun or does it look like a real gun?
It's a Red Rider.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's a Red Rider. I went on a camping trip up in Sequoia with some animation people that don't really know how to camp. On the drive up there, the guy I was riding up with was like, fuck, I forgot my BB gun. And I was like, so? Big deal. I'm going to throw rocks. He was very upset and we had to stop at a Walmart and he was going to buy a BB gun. And so I was thinking, well, I don't want to ask to use his BB gun while we're camping.
That's very faux pas.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, he's going to be shooting his BB gun that he bought, and then I'm going to have to ask if I can borrow it, and he's kind of a dick. So I bought my own BB gun, and I was in line in front of him at the checkout, and he saw me buy a BB gun. He was like, oh, well, then I don't need to buy a BB gun. I'll just borrow your BB gun. I was like, you're a fucking asshole. And then we got there and he was like, I wouldn't shoot that BB gun. That's like littering. It didn't get used at all. And it sits in my trunk.
So now you probably consider yourself more of a canyoneer than most of the other activities you do outside, would you say?
I mean, I hate labels. I think that's what other people would call me.
How'd that come about?
Should we preface what canyoneering is? Canyoneering is just descending a canyon course, a water course. That's it. That's what it says on Wikipedia.
That's right. And that can involve hiking and down climbing and jumping and
rappelling. Whoa, let's not overwhelm them with information. Right. They've already got the zebras.
That's right.
I was up at Henninger Flats on my first backpacking trip, which is above Eaton Canyon. Eaton Canyon in the Los Angeles area is the crown jewel of canyons here. And Henninger Flats is like the Los Angeles County Fire Department's Forestry Division's headquarters. I don't know if people know that, but there's always like a forester from the county stationed up there. And there's a little house because one time in the 1800s, somebody thought they were going to find some gold and they put some structures up. And then it just got donated to the county.
Is this going
to
be like a mustache story?
Yeah.
Where it's going to seem like a tangent, like you're going off in some other direction and then bam, suddenly, and that's why I was canyoneering?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, this is going nowhere. I was up there on my first backpacking trip and the forester that was stationed there at that time, I'm not going to say his name, her name, that person's name, fuck, was like, you know, you got to check in for your campsite. And then we started talking over the weekend while I was up there. And this person found out that I worked in animation and at a studio where that person and their immediate family really like to watch a lot on television. And I offered to give that person a tour of the studio just to be nice. And they declined. They're like, I work for the county. I can't accept anything from you. And I was like, yeah, okay, well, here's my number. Slide it across the table to him. I was like, you can text me when I'm not up here.
Him or her or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever gender this person is.
Yeah.
That you're not naming.
We'll just call him Skyler. So I was like, Skyler, you know, just give me a text later this week. It has nothing to do with me being up here now. We're just two people texting each other. Skyler sent me a text and was like, hey, how's it going? I was like, yeah, you can still have a tour. And came and got a tour of the studio. And then as a thank you, this person was like, hey, have you ever rappelled a waterfall before? And I was like, no, but I would really like to do something that dumb. They said, okay, yeah, I've been doing canyons with my dad here for like 30 years. And that's how I did my first canyon.
Interesting. That is not how I would have ever guessed.
Bribery. And they were like, don't ever tell anyone that we traded services. I'll lose my job. And I was like, of course I'll never tell anybody. Skyler. The weirdest part about it, now being a member of a community of outdoor people, is that person that took me on my first canyon, nobody knows who they are. They have never done any canyons with anybody in this community at all. It was totally outside of it. And it's still mind-blowing to me that there's other people out there that do canyons that we just don't know about.
That would be my experience too. I would stumble across people. I would think maybe I was going to recognize them. And then you'd notice that like they'd have like dynamic climbing ropes and ATCs, yeah. And you're like, okay, they probably don't do this very often. Probably none of the canyoneers I know them, but there are plenty of people interested in exploring those.
This guy wasn't even like a garbage canyoneer. Like, he had Sterling rope, like he had Piranha devices, like he was doing it all right. He even had like the West Coast canyoneering method of like the Sterling chain reactor. I was like, where did this guy learn all this shit? And he stays off of social media. She stays off of, fuck.
Thanks, Skyler.
Yeah, thanks a lot, buddy. Eventually, I bought them a pair of canyoneering shoes as like a thank you. Because later on, they were like, man, I've taken a lot of people canyoneering and nobody has ever just really ran with it. And I was like, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, so where'd you go from there? Because eventually you got instruction. And I just assumed you were another California. I found out about Klaus's classes and took a class story. But you've got a much more interesting story.
I went with some of Skylar's friends on another canyon or two. And at one point, they were garbage canyoneers. They stuck a rope in Vivian and didn't have any webbing with them. And I was standing in a canyon trap thinking, I'm going to die in here with these idiots. And when we got out, then I looked up classes, because I think everybody that takes classes has that moment where it's very, very uncomfortable being at the mercy of another person's skill level. You're like, I want to make sure I have the training so that I can get myself out of a situation. And then I looked up Klaus's classes.
Yeah, and where'd you go from there? Because I know that you've done more than just like take the introductory canyon classes and go out to do canyons. You've moved on to like instructor status and other things, right?
Yeah, again, more fucking labels, Jason.
I'm just here to take you and shove you into a box and force you to be recognized.
Everything that Klaus offered, I took. All four level classes and then his guide certification program. I've taught some classes, because canyoneering doesn't have a nationally recognized organization to say, you know, you're qualified to do this. I really don't like to talk about qualifications, because I could just make up a school and say I've got this training or certification.
But that doesn't stop you from trying to use that to get pro deals wherever you can, or get free memberships to climbing gyms, does it?
Fuck you. No, if I have a certification that is recognized by an organization and they will give me shit, I will accept it. That is true.
So that's something I've never followed up with you on. We both joined a climbing gym that opened up out here last year, and you managed to get a free membership because you were going to teach rappelling classes for them. How did that turn out?
Great. That was actually a really wonderful experience. And I should probably send them another email. Yeah, shout out to Touchstone Climbing Gym Incorporated Company, TM. They're a big California climbing gym chain, and they started popping up locations here in LA, and they opened one in Burbank, which is where I live. I used to live until this podcast came out and I had to move. So you guys don't know where I live.
Pretty good chance you're back in Ohio at this point.
Yeah, I was like, I'm gonna use a pro deal and just get like a cheap membership here. Yeah. And so I went to their soft opening and asked the manager. I was like, hey, you guys have discounts for certified guides? And they're like, no. And then I was like, oh, well, maybe I can teach them classes for you. That manager was not interested. She was like, you can email our program director. And she gave me his email address. And then I emailed him and said, can I do some workshops for you guys for a membership? And they were very responsive to that. Said, let's do a phone chat. What do you have in mind? They let me design a curriculum and stuff. And it was cool. And I did that all last year. When I say all last year, like I traded, if I were to bill them per hour for my time, I gave them that many hours for a climbing gym membership. So it felt fair.
And what were you doing? You were just doing rappel workshops?
I was really doing like an intro to canyoneering kind of thing. Like, this is what canyoneering is. Like, you're here climbing. This is another thing you can do with those skills. But it's a climbing gym. Nobody has any actual skills in there. In California, they're just a bunch of hipsters who've never been outside. They're just going to the climbing gym to take selfies and put it on their Instagram. I basically just wanted to scare the shit out of people. So I'd bring up all kinds of like photos of Scott Sweeney trips and stuff. You know, I had like an iPad and we just like all sit down on the floor and I'd show them what gear was and tell them how easy it is to die. And then I'd laugh like a crazy person. And I knew they'd never go into a canyon that way. So I didn't want anybody to do like a 2-hour workshop and be like, yeah, I've got the skills. They're going to be an accident waiting to happen. It was really like a 2-hour lecture of why you need to take more training before you do any of the shit we're talking about.
What, did you give them any sort of training at all?
Yeah.
Practice rappelling?
And yeah. I didn't realize that most climbers suck at rappelling.
So here's the thing. I mean, I actually think, despite giving you crap for everything I possibly can, that this can be really valuable, because as one of those somewhat rare people that climbs and canyoneers, I see the value in the different disciplines and what they have to share with each other that they don't typically share with each other. And climbers typically don't like rappelling. It's a thing you have to do to get off certain routes. So you just learn a method to do it. But people aren't particularly adept at it. They aren't great at managing anchors. You'd find climber tat, which is just tons and tons of sun-baked webbing around trees.
Anchors.
And people are like, well, I don't know if it's good. I'll put another piece of webbing on and then just attach it to these other. And so I think it could be super valuable to climbers to learn about rappelling from canyoneers who rappel constantly.
That was how I built the curriculum. Climbing and canyoneering are very much like skateboarding and rollerblading were in the 90s, to date myself. Like skiing and snowboarding, like they're out in the same areas together, but there's almost like a feud going on between the two of them.
Well, it's funny because like I know canyoneers, I think climbing is crazy. And I know climbers, I think canyoneering is crazy. And then I know a few people that do both.
It's very good to have somebody that can climb well in a canyon. But yeah, I built the curriculum of, okay, this is what your climbing skills are. This is how it would translate. And then I realized that they have no climbing skills. So like in the first workshop I gave, I was like, who's rappelled in here before? And nobody raised their hand. I was like, well, fuck that curriculum. I was like, let's just talk about rappelling.
So do you have any plans for these things beyond this? You've bothered to get instructor certification, which you've said is only valuable to a certain degree. Do you have any further intentions in doing anything with that? Or did you just want to have that knowledge that you would gain from going that far in the process?
Yeah, as far as doing it professionally.
Or just any plans outside of that? Or any goals outside of it? It doesn't even necessarily have to be career-based.
I hate outdoor people. I hate the outdoor community. Everybody is a narcissistic shitbag. I don't want to teach, I've watched that tear relationships apart with how competitive it is. And it's difficult to make a living doing outdoor activities, whether you're a brand representative or an influencer or even just making podcasts. This is not going to make you filthy rich until this episode comes out.
Just for the record, this podcast has only ever cost me money. It has never made me money. It is not my job, which apparently some people think is the case.
Yeah, I like going outside to get away from the city, to get away from people. So I'm going to keep doing that regardless, whether I'm canyoneering or just going for a hike. I don't really care. I don't have a bucket list of things I need to do or canyons I want to descend. And I try to stay away from people that are like that because they annoy me. At this point, I really kind of exiled myself from the whole community because of how toxic it was feeling for me and how unhealthy it was making me. I just want it to be fun. I already have my dream career and I've ruined that. But so why do it to another area of my interest?
You don't have to go super in depth, but you're going to have to further explain how you got into this activity and it became toxic.
No.
Because usually the story is the opposite. And that the community is, you know, communities are great. And then you learn to love all these people beyond.
Those people don't love anybody. They love themselves. Anybody that's doing something you could easily die doing is doing it for some probably fucked up reason. No, normal people don't do that. Go tell somebody like in the city what you do on the weekends and their eyes bug out. Like, why would you do that? It's probably because you're trying to prove your self-worth to others or to yourself. It's almost like therapy for a lot of these people.
So what's the reason that you do it?
I told you, I just hate people. I like trees and squirrels.
Right, but you could just go hang out with trees and squirrels. You wouldn't have to do potentially life-threatening activities. So why do you choose to do those activities?
Probably there's a level of fucked upness that I have that...
I can't imagine such a thing.
The idea of dying isn't a big deal to me. I don't care. I don't get adrenaline rushes. I've seen other people just like get off rappel and just yell, woo, like they're at a Wilco concert or something. I don't get any real rush. Sometimes I'll have adrenaline of like, this is really dangerous. I can't believe we're going off of this anchor. But for the most part, I find canyon descents just to be a lot of work. I don't even typically enjoy them that much.
So then why do you do them? Are you just doing them for the Instagram photos?
I like photography. I think most people that know me know that I like to take pictures. You know, that's like a byproduct of art school. Having photography was thrown in with my degree. So I ended up learning how to do photography as part of my undergrad. I've always been passionate about it because it's an area of the arts that's pretty scientific, mechanical instrument. And the more you understand about your instrument, the better art you can produce. I have like 20 cameras and they all do different stuff, but it's fun for me to take photos. And anybody that's done a trip with me knows I'm really into taking photography while we're there, but that's not why I do it. I haven't even posted on Instagram in like a month. The Instagram people are also as narcissistic and horrible as the rest of the outdoor community. They're very much seeking other people's approval.
So let's hear a quick rundown of how you got into this activity. It was great, but then somehow turned toxic. And you don't have to give like
you want the particulars. Names.
Yeah, you don't need to worry about that.
There was this one person. That's a broad topic. We should have started with that. How did it specifically become toxic? It's not one thing. Well, it's really not one thing. And I don't want to throw the whole community under the bus or really any one individual or even say that trying to prove something to yourself or others is a bad thing. You're just going to get me into a lot of trouble with this topic.
I think you get yourself in enough trouble without my help. So you can blame me all you want. But come on, this is you. And again, you can be as broad as you want. You don't have to give particulars.
I really want the communities to succeed. And anybody that knows me knows that I put on my own rendezvous. And I will take as many new people as I can into canyons because I want to introduce people into this activity. And I'd love to see it become as popular as rock climbing. So yeah, I'm a family man. I don't know what else to say about it.
What are you trying to avoid saying?
I'm not trying to avoid saying anything. I could talk about individual relationships, but those are things between me and those people.
I don't want us to turn it into a conversation about this person. I don't get along with this person. I don't get along with that person. I'm just trying to get clarification.
Who doesn't get along with me? What the fuck are you talking about?
I don't know. I can't imagine any people that don't get along with you.
You have to ask me more specific questions for me to find a direction to talk about it. As far as like, what do you find wrong with the community?
Well, and that's not what I'm saying.
I think the community itself is amazing. Depending on which locale you're in, like the Utah community is not the same as the Southern California community. And they have different ideas of how open that community should be with their canyons. I mean, I have a lot to say about that. Yeah, I don't know which direction you want me to go with it.
Basically, so you had mentioned that it got toxic and now you just kind of want to get away from people in the community. So I'm just trying to get you to clarify what that statement means.
I don't feel like I fit in with the outdoor community, to just be blunt about it. I'm just not doing the canyons for the same reason they are. I mean, maybe sometimes they just feel a little too zealous for me. Do you know what I'm saying?
I'm just listening, man. That's what I'm here for.
No, I thought it was supposed to be a conversation. Fuck. Yeah, you're going to have to edit a whole lot of this shit out.
Well, no. So I think this could be valuable stuff to talk about, right? Because oftentimes what you're going to hear, and it even is going to happen on this podcast a lot, which is people saying, I didn't fit in society. I found this outdoor community. That's where I fit in. That's where I found all this purpose. And you, to a certain degree, are having a different experience, which I think is worth inspecting that, because it is kind of insincere to always present this positive angle to it, and that maybe someone can come in and feel like they don't fit in with certain groups.
I guess I call bullshit on anybody that says, like, I didn't have a place in society and then I found this group and now I feel like I fit in. I just call bullshit on that. And that's a blanket statement. We'd have to talk about individual people that have said that and why they feel that way and talk about the psychology of it. But I'm going to make a blanket statement and just say bullshit.
I mean, that's kind of what you said about the animation community, though, which is you
don't
you
use my own
in,
words against
you,
me.
You fit in with the animation community.
I didn't say I fit in. I don't really fit in with any one niche. Like, I don't tell the animation community what I do on the weekends. Like, they don't know that I'm on Instagram. And even if they stumbled across my Instagram, they'd be like, that's a different guy. Because I don't want them to be freaked out that I have a whole lot of knives and axes at home. Does that make sense? The animation community, they're so docile and friendly and open and nerdy and dorky and loving, and they just want to play with toys and watch cartoons. Like, they'd freak the fuck out if they knew I was rappelling off of cliffs on the weekend. But part of me fits in with that. And I guess part of me fits in with the outdoor community, in that I do love the part where you go downhill in canyons. I have a hard time wrapping my head around some of the mindset of hellacious trips people plan. The trip could be good if you just did it in twice the amount of time, but they want to cram so much into just 3 days that it's terrible. Have you been on one of those trips? Do you know what I'm talking about? Because that's like every trip I get invited on is fucking terrible. Like, nobody wants to just go into a canyon and then have a rest day in there and, you know, have a little campfire and talk about life. They want to go and get it done.
Dude, you need to hang out with my buddies, it sounds like.
Cause I ain't ever been in for everybody at home. I have never been invited on one of Jason's trips.
For the record, I rarely put trips together. Other people tend to put trips together and get around to it much more frequently than I do. I'm kind of a last-minute planner, whereas I've got other buddies that are planning shit out like 6 months ahead of time. But so the experience you just described you're not having is the experience I am often having, which is we go for a few days. We don't go too crazy. We just do what's mostly reasonable. And then we do hang around a campfire and talk about our feelings and other shit.
Yeah, that's my dream trip. I don't get invited on too many trips. Or if I do, I'm like, what are you planning on doing? Oh, no, that sounds terrible. By and large, for my personal trips, they are really last minute. Like, I will plan something on Thursday to do the next day or that weekend. I'm very spontaneous. If it's an event that I'm trying to organize, those are planned out 6 months in advance. I'd like to sort of grow rendezvous to the level that the Red Rock Rendezvous exists. I'd love to see canyoneering rendezvous be better organized and more frequent and bigger than what they are currently, which most of the time is just Facebook invites. You know, there's some in Zion, but I think it would be pretty rad to see them take place all over the West. Just something more organized and more inviting than 8 people getting an Airbnb somewhere and being real cheap about their trip to the Pacific Northwest or wherever they're going.
That seems very specific, but I...
That's not about anybody specific. I see people do their trips and they have their core group and they really just stick with their core group, and that's great. Maybe part of me is just jealous I don't have a core group, but that's kind of the only events I see take place. When I look at people's photos on Facebook, they have groups and then they're very exclusive about it. And I would like to see events that are very inclusive to anybody that wants to go. With that in mind, there's a few people I wouldn't want to see.
One thing I love about the things you say is how you'll completely contradict yourself from moment to moment, but there's still truth.
Because
in,
you'll
in
throw
both
it
sides.
In my face in about 3 minutes. If you go on any of the Facebook groups for canyoneering specifically, it takes about 5 minutes to realize it's a toxic place. Everybody's going to shit talk you. You can't go on, hey, it's my first time doing a canyon. I'm going to go do Pine Creek. Within minutes, there'll probably be 3 or 4 comments that are like, you shouldn't be doing a canyon if you don't know what you're doing. Nobody's saying, hey, I'd love to come and help you get through this and not get hurt or have a better time or be safe about it. People are pretty nasty.
Something you're bringing up, which I agree is an issue, especially when it comes to the internet. And this happens with a lot of things, right? People get into this activity, they move past the point of novice to having some sort of knowledge and skill.
Yeah.
And then they forget what it was like to be a novice and decide it's time to judge novices instead of aiding them.
Yeah, the terrible twos. It's their second year into the activity. And I would say, I'm too scared to go back and look at my comments from that many years ago, but I'm sure I did the same thing. I don't know why that's part of our culture, but it seems that almost everybody does it until maybe most people don't even stop doing it. They just start ragging on everybody and their skill level when they're a new person.
I mean, some people continue to be that way forever. And I think some people move past it. And then either they just extract themselves from that entirely, or they realize, oh, maybe I could offer my help to these people instead of...
Yeah, I can't think of a trip I've been on, at least in the last year, which is like 50 canyons. I can't think of one trip where I didn't see someone doing something wrong. And those are all skilled people I was with. I'll just quietly watch somebody rig something. And if it's something that I think is dangerous, I'll say something about it. But I can always see a better way to do it. And I think it's so ironic that all of these people that think they know what the fuck they're doing just start jumping down first year outdoor canyoneers' throats. And there's no way they know what the fuck they're talking about. There's just no way. Because I'm that much better than they are. That's what I'm trying to say. At some point, they forget that they still have a whole lot to learn.
And it's interesting because I talked to somebody for this show not long ago who is an instructor for REI, and some of these sorts of same issues came up to a certain degree. And one of the things he mentioned was that he was a surfer, decided to get into stand-up paddleboarding, and it for him was an opportunity to be a beginner again, and how he embraced that and how that made him not only better at stand-up paddleboard, but then helps him improve elsewhere, because then he can stop and recognize where maybe he's missing skills or missing experiences.
Sure.
And recognize that those are things to work on.
I could very much relate with that.
I think it's valuable information.
I love learning new things. And maybe part of that's why I like inviting new people into canyons, is because I like experiencing it vicariously through them. And it also makes me better at the activity with the repetition of showing people how to do it correctly. I'm making quote fingers with that, because there isn't always one right way to do it. So
yeah, and the things you just said about bringing a new person out, re-experiencing it for yourself, and then helping yourself improve by educating other people, these are topics that come up on this show all the time.
Oh, well then fuck this
topic. So I don't know why you bothered to come on.
What a waste of time. Sorry to waste your time.
Yeah. But I think there is a point where you can move past, if you have to go through the terrible twos that you're talking about, where you can move past and then realize, wait, I should bring out new people for those exact reasons. And I think maybe you've hit a point where you're hitting a whole bunch of the terrible twos, and we need to extract you from them and get you to meet some of the three-year-olds and the four-year-olds.
Well, I think if we just sort of put a name on it, give it an identity, then we can call people out on it for doing that. And next time you see somebody doing it, you can just be like, yo, man, you're being a little harsh. You know, you still have a lot to learn yourself. You didn't die in your first year, too.
Yeah, and something that people on the show talk about a lot of times is the dumb experiences we had when we were learning to do these activities.
Fuck, I've almost died so many times. I'm sure that I've done more dangerous accidents on my trips than most of the people that have been on your show. I'm a huge risk taker, and I'm not proud of that. And it took me a while to learn that that's not safe behavior. I shouldn't be admitting this to everybody. I'm safe now. You should definitely do trips with me. It'll be fun. But I've made mistakes. I've made lots of mistakes. I'll be the first to admit that.
So I think we've reached a point where we've been talking for a while. We've covered a lot of different topics.
It's over?
It's about to be.
Oh, all right.
It's going to be. We got a couple more things we're going to do.
Okay.
But before we wrap it up, let's tell people, if they were listening and like, man, that Daniel Elson's an interesting character. I sure wish I had more than this podcast to know about him. Where can people go to keep up with Daniel Elson?
Yeah, you just find me on Instagram. That's it. It's my name. There'll be a link to it on however you got to this podcast.
That is true. Yes, there will be.
Yeah.
I know how it works. Is that the only way you want people to find you?
Yeah, don't find me on Facebook. Go fuck yourself. I'm not going to go on Facebook because I'm not uncool. What? Double negative?
Too many negatives.
I'm too cool for Facebook.
So we can find Daniel Elson on Instagram at Daniel Elson. And then the final thing I always do on the show is give you an opportunity to either further discuss something we've discussed so far that you feel like maybe we haven't covered completely, or to just wrap it up with a final thought that you'd like to leave people with based on the things we've talked about, or clarify something if you feel like you didn't get to earlier. Or you can give mustache tips.
Shave off your mustache. There can be only one. Can we say that?
Yeah, I don't think it was trademarked.
Okay. I don't know. Can we start over? I feel like I'm awake now. Let's do this again tomorrow. Can we take a couple calls?
Yeah. Yeah, so we're going to go to Susie
out
of Milwaukee, and she wants to know where you got those glasses.
I'm not wearing glasses.
Next question.
Yeah. We got them at the glasses store.
What do you want to leave people with?
If you want to do some canyons, just send me a message. We'll go do some canyons. If you want to go backpacking, we'll do that. Or if you just want to car camp and get drunk, that is my favorite.
All right. If you don't have anything more to say, then we're going to call that the show.
Okay.
All right.
I'm good with that.
And now you know what time it is. It's time to run to the internet and go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 81 with Daniel Elson, and there you will find photographs and links. Although in this case, it's only one link to his Instagram page. And you can look for past episodes of the show, including episode 79 with Mike Kelly, who was the person who mentioned that be a beginner mentality that we were talking about earlier in this episode. So if that piqued your interest, go back, check out episode 79 with Mike Kelly. But I want to hear from you. We want to hear from you here at the show. I'm really curious to hear what you all have to say about this episode. Get in touch with us. You know how to do it. Send us an email, go@butcherbirdstudios.com, or use an antiquated telephone device. Leave us a voicemail or send us a text, 818-925-0106. And while you're there on the internet, how about doing me a great favor? Subscribe to the show, rate, review, share it with somebody who loves mustaches. This episode of the Go Get Outside podcast was produced and recorded with additional editing by me, your host, Jason Milligan. This episode was edited by Griffin Davis, and as always, this has been brought to you by Butcher Bird Studios. Next time on the show, come back April 1st, April Fool's Day, for Courtney Condi. She is the founder of Occupation Wild, a website devoted to helping others find jobs in the outdoors, and hear a story about how not going to Coachella can change your life. April 1st, Courtney Condi. See you then.
You have questions prepared?
No, I don't ever come in prepared.
This explains the success of your show.